Next week, we'll do a special PowerPoint for the festival occasion of Shivaratri, and it's held at the same time as our regular Sunday feast at 5 o'clock, but there'll just be a whole bunch more things going on in connection with Lord Shiva. There'll be a drama, there'll be a couple of different Indian dance programs by a couple of different Indian dancers, there'll be chanting 108 names of Lord Shiva, there'll be a special bathing ceremony. So we'll do the first part of this show called Going the Extra Mile this week. It'll be interrupted next week, and then we'll resume it 2 weeks from today. Another title for this might be How to Keep on Keeping On. And anyone who is interested in the subject matter of this is welcome to correspond with us by email, utahkrishnas@gmail.com. We also have our membership class online with a PowerPoint at the website www.utahkrishnas.org. All of these talks on Sunday afternoon are based on the teachings of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. You see a statue there. You see him also on the altar. He's the founder of our International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He established between 1965 and 1977 the first 108 Hare Krishna temples all over the world, and now there are about 400 temples worldwide. So going the extra mile, we thought we'd start out with a cartoon. Going the extra mile is not always a positive thing. If you're listening online or the podcast, I have to describe it to you verbally. We see a taxi cab as it's going away from us. The taxi cab has a motto on the trunk of the taxi cab that says, "We go the extra mile." So you see the taxi cab as it's driving away, you see the back of the taxi driver's head, and you see a hapless-looking passenger looking out the back window saying, "Hey, that was my stop back there." So we thought we'd cover the negatives first, you know, that going the extra mile is not always in every circumstance a positive thing, but mostly it is. And those people that want to make the most out of their lives, you know, God has created us and He's got a plan for us, got an exciting plan for us. And if you're not feeling fulfilled and exciting in your job, it's because maybe you haven't quite listened to that little voice deep inside of you, which is planted by God. It's a desire to be all that you were made to be. Every one of us has this voice or this innermost desire to make the most of our lives and to employ our talents and abilities. And if you're not hearing that, maybe you just need to get off your iPod and turn the TV off a little more often, go for some solitary walks in the mountains, and try to pay attention to that voice and those desires that are inbuilt within you. Because that tension is there for a reason. It's meant to keep us from being complacent, to keep us from being bored, to jostle us a little bit out of our comfort zone, to take us from the safe zone sometimes to the faith zone, and make of our life an adventure. So every life of every great person starts with a desire, and there's a tension there between what society would like us to do, what society molds us to do, and what God has made us to do. And they're two different things. So we start with a tension. We start with a desire to be more than what we are. But most people, even if they recognize that desire, if they hear that voice, they're scared, for one reason or another, to act upon that desire. They're hesitant to make a decision. And so that often trips up nine out of 10 people that even recognize the desire in the first place. Now, what we're going to talk about today is not the desire. It's not the decision. We're going to talk about the third factor that's common to all spiritually successful people, and that is determination. You can't get anywhere without a commitment. Every week when we give these talks, we're encouraging people to make a commitment, not necessarily here, but get in some church family, get in some synagogue family, get in some temple family, and make a commitment. Just like if you have a couple, they're living together. I say there's so much more in that relationship. There's so much more potential when you make the marriage commitment. When you get up to the altar and you say, "I don't know what the future holds, but I am going to vow to live that future with this person above all others." And the other person says that. There's so much more that comes, that's generated from those two little words, "I do," that you cannot even imagine without having made that commitment. So in every way, the higher values, the higher treasures, the higher satisfaction, the higher maturity are made through commitments. And you cannot make a commitment and keep a commitment without this quality, which is called determination. Other euphemisms for it are laying it on the line, put your money where your mouth is, walk the talk. And so we're going to talk about determination this week. Once you have had a desire and you've made a decision, it's not all roses from there on in. It's not like everything falls into place. In fact, once you've set your course and made a commitment, there are other forces. In Indian culture, we call this Maya. Maya, the goddess of tripping you up, the goddess of matter, the goddess of illusion. She makes it her business to throw roadblocks in your way. She sets into motion forces that are meant to slow down your determination, your enthusiasm, and your impetus. She uses the economy, you know, the depressed economy, the job market, the loaning market. She uses personal problems to deflate you and to discourage you. She may use the marriage situation, the fact that your partner is not exactly seeing eye to eye with you on various things, to make you want to throw in the towel, give it up, toss it up, and bail. That's the duty of Maya, and that's what you expect once you sort of set your course. And so if you want to become all that you're meant to be in life, then you've got to learn how to deal with discouragement. You've got to bring determination, the D of determination, up against the D of discouragement, and the D of determination hopefully will prevail. Those personalities are called mahatmas. In Sanskrit, atma means soul, and we're all souls. We're all atmas, tiny individual souls in material bodies. And mahat means great soul. So there are so many people who are just going about a humdrum life, breathing oxygen, taking up space, and are going to die without ever having achieved a real level of satisfaction. Mahatmas are separated from the crowd, so to speak. And here's how they're described. You'll notice the word determination is couched in this verse here from the 9th chapter, 14th verse of the Bhagavad Gita. The Sanskrit is mahatmanastu mam partha devim prakritim ashritaha. Always chanting my glories, Krishna says, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me, these great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. There's an old adage which says that one finds God quickest whose yearning is strongest. So we can just picture the mahatmas yearning, wanting to revive their relationship with God, wanting to find the meaning of life, wanting to chart the right, most meaningful course, so badly that they can taste it. So badly that tears flow down their eyes. So badly do they want this, that they want for themselves what God wants for them. Now, there have been many books written about how to be a success in life. This is a book, I'm not sure it was ever written, but it's called How to Become a Total Failure. The 10 Rules of Highly Unsuccessful People. We're from Utah Valley, right? This is the origin of Stephen Covey's The 7 Secrets of Highly Successful People. So if there was a book to be written about highly unsuccessful people, it might look and read like this, you'd see. And one of the secrets of highly unsuccessful people, or maybe it's not such a secret after all, is that 90% of people in life fail. They don't fail because of lack of talent or lack of ability. They fail because of lack of persistence. They fail because they just give up too soon. Krishna was on the... What are those quotes? I'm not sure. I can't read them here. The son is sulking. He's got his chin on his hands and his elbows and his knees. And he says, I feel like such a failure. And the father is trying to buck him up, you see, trying to cheer him up. So the father says, come on, son, you're only 16. I was over 40 before. I was sure that I was a failure. Have you ever felt like this when you tried a new cake, or maybe even worse, it's the same cake that you've cooked a number of times and it always turned out this way? This cake is a failure, you are a failure too, and no one will ever love you. So we live in a negative society. We live in a society that kind of dooms us to failure. They want us to just be consumer items. They just want us to go out and buy things, you know, like automatons. And so when we step out in faith and we try to be something different than what the advertising prompts us to be, we're bucking against the tide. We're swimming up the stream. This happened to Krishna also. The Lord Krishna appeared on the planet 5,000 years ago. He was on the planet for 125 years. And you can read all about those pastimes in a big book downstairs called the Krishna Book. And in the Krishna Book, on one occasion, Salya, a tyrannical sort of yogi, mystic, black mystic yogi. He attacked Krishna's city, and in order to demoralize Krishna, Salya conjured up an image of Krishna's father Vasudev, and in front of Krishna he cut off the head of Vasudev, hoping to demoralize Krishna. And as he did it, he said, "Look, Krishna, you rascal, this is your father who has begotten you, and by whose mercy you are still living. Now just see how I kill your father." So Krishna is God. He knows past, present, and future. He's also in the hearts of all living beings. So he wasn't really taken in by this magic show. But in order to model behavior for us, he went along with appearances for a moment or two. He identified with the appearance. "Oh my gosh, this rascal has got my father, and my father is dead. Ha 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 ha." Now, if that were to happen to you or me, we'd be totally unmanned. We'd be totally paralyzed. We would be unable to raise a hand against our aggressor. And Krishna sort of did that for a moment, you know, but he showed us that we need to go beyond appearances. We can't just accept appearances. There are times when we just got to say that no matter how deep or how dark or how desperate or how impossible it appears to be, I'm not giving up. And at that point, it just may be just sheer stubbornness. It just may be sheer doggedness and nothing else. Of all the various virtues, determination is the one with the most rough edges. I go down to BYU 3 mornings a week and I run in the field house. And especially in the winter, the various sports teams, you can see them coming and going and all. And they don't have their uniforms on because they're practice, so they're kind of in grubbies and all. So you kind of have to, you know, as I run around, I just do this mental thing. I try and figure out, based on their body types, what team they're on. And if they're, you know, if they're kind of light-boned and preppy, that's the golf team, you know. If they're huge and muscular, with big strong arms and calves, you know, I can just see, you know, one is a running back breaking tackles, and I can see another one as a linebacker crushing running backs, you know, fairly obvious. If they're short and compact and like just like ready to like twang, that's the gymnastic team. See what I'm saying? Now, there's a certain group of guys, it's always guys, they don't have a girls team of this, but they look neither preppy nor footballish, nor compact. Some of them have flattened noses and puffy lips, and they talk kind of rough and all like that. And I'm thinking, that's got to be the rugby team. These guys, you know, they're scrappers, they're street fighters, you know, and they give the impression they don't always play by the rules, you know what I'm saying? Determination, if I had to personify it, be kind of like the rugby team. You know, I don't care what it looks like. I don't care what the odds are. I don't care what the bets are, whether they're 21. I don't care. I'm just going to keep on keeping on. I'm going to see this thing through the end. I'm not going to give up. And that's what determination looks like. So even though Krishna apparently saw his father beheaded in front, he said, and he just for a moment he got taken back. He pretended to go along with appearances. The next moment he just resumed the fight and he said, "Sala, I don't care for your magic show." And this happened on another occasion too. When Krishna was a little child in Vrindavan, Kamsa, it was predicted that Krishna would kill the tyrant Kamsa. And though, so Kamsa tried to preempt Krishna by killing him. And when Krishna was a little child sporting in Vrindavan with his boyhood friends, Kamsa deputed a protean wizard named Agasura to come to kill Krishna. And Agasura assumed the form of a large snake. He lay down on the pathway, and the Krishna book describes his appearance as follows. Agasura's mouth appeared to be like a big mountain cave. His height could not be estimated. His chin was raised just like a mountain summit. And his tongue appeared to be like a long highway. And inside his mouth it was as dark as a cave. Now Krishna's friends, they know that Krishna's God, even though he's playing the role of an ordinary person. So they never are afraid of anything. So they weren't afraid or intimidated by this fearsome thing. He had a fishy smell. You know, his breath was like a whirlwind and it smelled fishy. And his boyfriends, as you can see from the picture, they said, "Hey, let's just go in. Let's just go. We know it's a big demon come to crawl us up. But let's just go in and see what Krishna does. Because seeing what Krishna does is so much fun. Seeing how Krishna deals with these situations." So they just walked right in. And then here it describes Krishna's reaction momentarily. It says, when Krishna saw that his friends were already out of his hands and were lying within the belly of a great serpent, he became momentarily aggrieved. He was also struck with wonder at how the external energy works so wonderfully. Krishna himself was aggrieved for a moment by appearances. And that's not to say that we can't be taken aback or a little bit crestfallen when things don't go the way we want them to go, but it doesn't mean that we give up. And neither did Krishna. In spite of the fact that his friends had disappeared in the belly of the snake and the snake had closed his mouth and everything seemed to be lost, Krishna then reached down, if you can think of God as reaching down inside of himself, and then he just went and he pried open the demon's jaws. He entered into there and he made himself hot like 10,000 suns. And he burst through the hole. He made a hole in the top of the demon's head and killed him, at which time his body became slack and all of his friends came out. And everything ended felicitously. In the great epic Mahabharata, we also read about five devotees of Krishna who, because of their devotion to Krishna, were subjected to all kinds of trials and tribulations and difficulties. These are the famous five Pandavas. If you read the Mahabharata, you'll become intimately familiar with these five great personalities. The eldest is Yudhisthira, the next one is Bhima, then Arjuna, the great archer, and then the two twins, Nakula and Sahadeva. They were cheated out of their kingdom by a crooked dice match. They almost lost their wife in the same game of dice. They were exiled into the forest for 14 years. They could only take the clothes on their back. And for 14 years, they're sitting, passing time, waiting to come back and reclaim their kingdom. Now, in the meantime, their enemies, headed up by Duryodhana, the ones that had cheated them in the first place, they were planning how to crush the Pandavas at the end of those 14 years exile and not give the kingdom back. So the Pandavas are sitting in the forest, living from hand to mouth, dodging dangers and wild animals and all like this. And they're wondering, how are we ever going to contend with our enemies after 14 years of exile? Has anyone been in exile before? If I send you up into the Wasatch Mountains for 14 years, there's no Gold's Gym, there's no place to work out, there's no good nutrition, there's no Jamba Juice out there, you see? You know, all those things that warriors do to keep fit, you can't do when you're in exile. In the meantime, their enemies, they got gold gems all over the place, you know. They got sparring partners, they got personal trainers, you know, they got super duper creatine, you know, and all this stuff, nutritional supplements and everything. And their only thought is, we got to build ourselves up so that when the Pandavas come weak and distracted out of the forest, we can just stomp them like that. And those kings were making alliances, they were bribing other kings and strengthening their ties, all with this specific aim of crushing the Pandavas when they come out of the forest. And the Pandavas themselves were aware of all that, and they're thinking, why has Krishna put us in this situation? It seems as if everything from appearances is hopeless. Yudhisthira, during that time, might have very well said these words. We're hard-pressed on every side, but we're not crushed. We're perplexed, but we're not in despair. We're persecuted, but we're not abandoned. We're struck down, but we're not destroyed. In other words, Yudhisthira says that while on the outside everything seems to go against me, I am not defeated. You're only defeated when you allow yourself to be defeated. It's only your attitude of defeat that can actually defeat you. So if you don't give up your attitude of defeat, then you can never, ever be defeated. And if you think of God as being on your side for you, then you'll never give up. You'll never give up. It is said that if God is for you, who can stand against you? So the Pandavas, they had been faithful to Krishna, and because of their faithfulness, they were put into these dire circumstances. But they knew that the nature of God is that He always rewards faithfulness. He always rewards faithfulness. If we show some faithfulness to Him, He never abandons us. So even though everything was dark and desperate and impossible, the Pandavas felt buoyant. They felt cocky. There was a bounce to their step. And if you were not a God-conscious person and you were looking at the Pandavas in the forest, you'd be thinking, these people are nuts. They should have their chin on the ground. They should be wallowing pity. They should be saying, poor me. But they look like they're on top of the world. And if you've got a relationship with Krishna or God, you will feel on top of the world, no matter what external appearances. In fact, the calculation is, as bad as it can seem, to the degree and to the proportion that it seems hopeless and dark and impossible, that when the triumph comes, that when God brings us from dead end to deliverance, it will be so glorious. I can't wait for that day. I can't wait for that day. And the triumph of the Pandavas was such that I'm here 5,000 years later telling the story in Spanish for Utah. So how's that? Were they right or were they right? See what I'm saying? So they refused to give up. They refused to give up. And here's the nature of Krishna. Here's the nature of Krishna, which I'll just describe as soon as this comes back on here. This is some of the reasons why we can go through life, even under the darkest days, under the darkest, deepest shadows, with confidence. His person, Krishna's person, is full of different energies, and his determination is itself actual fact. This is important. When we may determine something, okay, I'm going to go from A to B, but I'm in the material world, I'm in a material body with earth, air, fire, and water covering me. There's all kinds of elements, there's friction. So I decide to go from A to B, but there's a lot of arrangements that need to be made. There's a lot of energy that needs to be put in there, and there's going to be a time lapse. And then I'm not sure that my will prevail. After all that, I'm still not sure that I'm going to get the outcome that I've worked for. That's not the case with God. His determination, as soon as he says, I want something to happen, it happens. His determination is non-different from the consummation of the activity. Whatever he determines is in that very instant an actual fact. So when the Pandavas were sitting in the forest, not working out, not getting a good diet, not practicing the military art, it didn't matter. Because Krishna had already determined that when they came out of exile 14 years later, because of righteousness on their side and because of God being on their side, he had already determined that they would win. And in the Bhagavad Gita, if you're familiar with the Bhagavad Gita, in the 11th chapter, there's a point, and we'll talk about this next week, where Arjuna can't quite get with the program. He's a little daunted by the fact that he's outnumbered and outmanned and outgunned, you see. And at that point, Krishna reveals his universal form. His form in which all the planets, all the inhabitants within the universe, all the species, past, present, and future is contained. A miraculous universal form. And Krishna says to Arjuna, he says, Arjuna, if you decide not to fight, it's not going to change anything. I have already determined, long time ago, to gather these miscreants together on the field of Kurukshetra. And I've determined that they're not going home. So you can get with the program or you cannot. But nothing can change my determination. It's already a fact. And in order to emphasize this point, as he's hovering over Arjuna in this gigantic form, Arjuna has this vision of the future, like about, you know, 2 hours from now. And he sees all the tyrants and all the miscreants and all the criminals flowing into the mouths of Krishna, being consumed by fire. And Krishna says, see, they're already put to death by my arrangement. So you can be but an instrument in the fight. But by omitting to fight, it's not going to change the outcome at all. Krishna's determination is an actual fact. We may think of doing something, but there's so many impediments. But when Krishna wants to do something, simply by his willing, everything is performed perfectly. And a little bit more here. Although he's a maintainer and sustainer of the entire material manifestation, he does not touch this material manifestation. See this image here. This is the spiritual planet of Krishna, shaped like the whorl of a lotus flower. And down on this side, your lower right-hand side, is the material world in which we live. This is called the Mahatattva. And obviously the difference between this dark world and this world of light is that this is the material world. There's matter. We're all covered with matter. Earth, air, fire, and water, and so on and so forth. The spiritual world of Krishna, there's no matter. It's all spirit through and through. Spiritual trees, spiritual grass, spiritual peacocks, spiritual cows, spiritual people, not covered by matter. So Krishna's abode is in the spiritual world. That's far, far away from here. And in fact, it says he never touches matter. He never touches matter. At the same time, simply by a supreme will, everything is created, everything is sustained, everything is maintained, and everything is annihilated. That means that though he never personally touches matter, he never becomes overwhelmed by matter, he pervades and supports this whole material creation by his energies. There is nothing outside of his influence. We see a cloud wafts across the sky on a summer day. Something is supporting that cloud. We can't see it, but something is supporting that cloud in the sky. So that which permeates and supports the cloud is air. It's everywhere throughout and present in the cloud, but you can't see it. So by the diffusion of his various energies, God, although he lives far away, everything is the diffusion of his energy. He enters into, he permeates, he pervades, and he supports this whole material creation. Nothing happens outside of his will. That's why I have a problem with Satan, who's some sort of a contender, you know, the number one contender. In God's creation, nothing happens outside of God's will. No one can carve an area of sovereignty in competition with God. Only if God allows that for a certain remedial or specific purpose. So he controls everything. He said, not a blade of grass moves, but it's not by the will of God. Not a sparrow falls from the sky, but it's by the will of God. And so there is nothing outside his area of influence. And if he wants something to happen, it will happen. And that's crucial for our understanding. If we want to be successful in life, we need to understand this. We're a society which is, you know, kind of programmed and brainwashed by Hollywood. We see Tom Cruise on the big screen, jumping out of airplanes, holding on to speeding trains, you know, gunning down 57 criminals, you know, within a 45-minute period. And we kind of get, like, we get just bedazzled, you see, by the illusion of the whole thing. The fact is that big people, big shots, extraordinary people, they're just little shots that kept on shooting. That's what they are. Don't go around looking for Colossuses and Hercules. The most extraordinary people are people right under your nose who have determination, who are ordinary people, but with an extraordinary amount of determination, persistence, steadfastness, endurance, faithfulness, not getting discouraged. You have a dream, you have a desire, you have some courage, so don't let anyone take that away. Keep it and persist with it, and then you are an extraordinary person. People that have made a difference in the world are not necessarily big colossuses, or would it be colossi? I don't know. They're just ordinary people who refuse to give up. Who refuse to give up. I have so much regard for Jerry. I see Jerry as a genius. Now, I think he's a genius because if there's a question I have, he will persist and persist and persist until he gets the answer. Long after I would give up. Some of us are more persistent in some areas than other areas. I may be persistent in some areas than Jerry. But Jerry is persistent in terms of technology, websites, and things like that. He is persistent. Earlier, our little recorder, for some reason, it went into the fast-forward mode and everything was going like this. And so Jerry, he has his iPad here. This is just a couple hours ago. He has his iPod. He goes online. He downloads the instruction manual for this Olympus 450 recorder. We're standing here in the temple. It would have never even occurred to me. And if I'd have tried it, I would be going screaming gaga, you know, out the doors into the snow after 5 minutes. He downloads the instruction manual for this recorder. And he goes through it. And it takes him about a half an hour, you know. And he finally figures out how to slow it down so that it records in real time. And I'm just like, Jerry, you're a genius. But it's so clear that his genius lies in his persistence. That's all. He's not going to give up. He's not going to let go. Great people are ordinary people with an extraordinary amount of persistence. I hear this all the time. I don't have any talent. I don't have any ability. I don't know why Krishna would be interested in me. If you have persistence, that persistence can produce talent in your life. And even if you don't have any ability, but you keep doing it long enough, eventually you're going to succeed. Persistence can actually create ability in your life. This is a story that Prabhupada tells in the Bhagavad Gita about a sparrow with an extraordinary amount of persistence and determination. She laid her eggs on the beach, and the ocean, the tide came in, and the ocean took her eggs away out to sea. So the sparrow came and she said, "Could you return my eggs, please?" And the ocean was just like, she didn't even bother to answer. "Just go away, little sparrow, you know, lay some more eggs or something. You're not going to get your eggs back from the ocean." But this was a special sparrow with an extraordinary amount of strength. She said, "If you're not going to give my eggs back, I'm going to dry you up." Oh, that's a good one. "Be my guest, you know." And the little sparrow started taking beakfuls of water, flying a mile or so inland to a desert area and deposit them. Back and forth and back and forth. And you can imagine her critics. You can imagine a number of fellow birds that tried to discourage her. You can imagine the scoffers, you know. "You stupid, silly, you know, unrealistic, naive little..." But she didn't even entertain for a moment the idea of giving it up. She was not going to give up. And her efforts came to the attention of Garuda. Here's Garuda here. Garuda, the bird carrier of Lord Vishnu. He is a plenary expansion of Lord Vishnu. The national airlines of Indonesia, this is a trivia fact, are known as Garuda Airlines. Garuda is unlimitedly powerful. So he took cognizance of the travails of his little sparrow cousin, and he arrived on the scene and he said, "Ocean! Give back the eggs now or else." As Garuda could drive, he could suck up the whole ocean in a second. So then the ocean gave back her eggs. Good story of determination. Con Edison, one of the biggest companies, multinational companies in the world, all started from an ordinary man with an extraordinary amount of persistence. Thomas Edison said, so many people called him a genius, he said, "My genius consists in 1% inspiration and 99% determination." He had to test 1,000 different elements before he found tungsten, which was the one that would work for the light bulb. So someone asked him once, "Don't you feel like a loser having failed 1,000 times, 1,000 different times?" And Edison said, "No, I found 999 things that didn't work." It didn't work. Imagine if he'd given up at 100, or 200, or 300, or 400. Imagine if Thomas Edison had given up at 999, and it was the 1,000th one that worked. Oftentimes, where the failure leaves off, the success picks up. That's exactly the point at which success is to be found. Where everybody else quits, there's 1 in 1,000 who will keep on at that point. So don't feel failure. Don't fear failure. Just fear giving up. Because that's when you fail. If you don't give up, you don't fail. You only fail when you give up. You're never a failure in your life till you give up. It doesn't matter if you've had a temporary setback. It doesn't matter if you've had a detour. Things haven't turned out the way that you wanted them to. You're never a failure until you give up. And it's always too soon to quit. A persistent person begins his point of success at the point someone else gave up. Failures give up at a certain point, and a persistent person takes up at the point, and he is successful. Once 3 frogs fell into a bucket of milk, and they couldn't get out. It was a long way to the edge, and it was all slippery. So they're paddling along, paddling along, paddling along, and the first frog says, "This is a waste of time. This is the way, it's doomed to fail. There's no way." So he stopped paddling and he sunk under the milk and drowned. The second frog, he was a little fitter. He'd been working out, you know, eating pretty good and all like that. So he went on for like another 15 minutes, you know, proud of his strength and all like that. But eventually, the appearance, you know, just the whole thing, you know, just got to him. And he was getting tired. And as he got tired, his mind began to prey upon him. And he began to be negative. And he thought, you know, what's the point? And he gave up, and he also drowned. The third little frog, he said, if there's a God, God helps those who help themselves. So I want to avail myself of that higher power. I want to go beyond the limits of my personal strength. I want to ask Him that if He desires, you please deliver me from this dire situation, and I will meet you halfway. I will give you everything. I will give you my might, up to and even beyond what is not anatomically and physiologically possible. If you will meet me in my brokenness, in my danger, in my dire circumstances. So he went far beyond what the two frogs had done. He went beyond appearances. He was thinking of an unknown, unseen power who created everything and who pervades and supports everything. And he knew one essential fact, that if I am persistent and if I am determined, and if it coincides with the will of God, I will get out of this. I see no way to do it. But if God wants it to happen, it will happen. And he kept paddling and paddling and paddling and paddling. Finally, when he just got to the limit, the absolute limit, and he couldn't paddle anymore, he said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to paddle one more time. And he just gave one more paddle. And I don't know how much you know about churning milk. But when you churn milk, you know, they actually have these paddles in India with little ropes, and village ladies, they churn and they paddle. There's actually a temple in Udupi where Krishna has this paddle, and Krishna did that when he was in. At a certain point, the milk becomes butter. And it was just that extra little flip, and the milk turned into butter, and he got solid footing, and then he jumped out of the pail of milk. Don't feel failure, fear giving up too soon. I think this is just priceless. I'll describe it for people that hear the podcast. The heron, the stork is swallowing the frog. The frog's going into the stork's gullet, head first, but not without wrapping its hands around the neck of the stork. And the caption says, never give up. Often success is right around the corner. Victory is just ahead of you, down the block, a few feet away. The sad thing is that most people give up too soon. They cop out in life. And there are four reasons why most people give up, and we're going to save these for, I said, next week is Shivaratri. 2 weeks from now, if you care to resume this, we'll resume it by discussing the four reasons why most people quit too soon. And we'll just list them here by way of concluding this segment. The first reason that we give up prematurely is we were never really serious about the goal in the first place. Second reason is we lose sight of our goal, becoming distracted. Third reason is we begin to live by our feelings rather than by our commitments. And the fourth reason is that we give in to criticism. Those we'll discuss 2 weeks from today.